stealthily running, scanning for other computers to infect, issuing small maintenance commands, working to protect itself from being discovered and removed, biding its time, and periodically checking in with its command center. The threat posed by a botnet is less to individual computer owners than to society at large. The Internet today is in its Wild West stage. You link to it at your own risk. Phil had no way to stop the spread of this new worm. He could only study it. And he could tell little about it at first. He knew roughly where his first sample had come from and that it was something unrecognized. He knew that it was a genius of a propagator. It had one other curious feature that he had never seen. It had a geographic lookup capability. This worm wanted to know where the machine it had just infected was located in the real world. The first step in dealing with any new malware is to unpack it, to break it open and look inside. Most malware comes in a protective shell of code, complex enough to keep amateurs from taking a close look. But Phil's Menlo Park wizards were pros. They had invented an unpacking program they called Eureka that readily cracked open 95% of what they saw. When they tried it on the new worm, it failed. Sometimes when Phil was stymied like this, he would just wait for one of the AV vendors to meet the challenge. But this worm was flooding in so fast that waiting was not an option. His infections log showed the same thing over and over again as the worm flooded in from everywhere. As he would later explain, there was literally nothing else for us to do. 2. MS-08-067. The world is no longer yours. The future has arrived, and a nation trembles. The X-Men Chronicles. The first reports of the new worm came to T.J. Campana from everywhere, in the form of instant messages and emails, from Phil Porras at SRI, from experts at Symantec, which markets the Norton antivirus software, from the network security geeks at iDefense, from F-Secure, a Finnish security firm, and from many others. This was on the first night. Hey, we're seeing something really weird. Something's happening. TJ wasn't surprised. He knew what it was. He had been waiting for a worm like this one for months. He is a program manager for security at Microsoft's Digital Crimes Unit, which is to say that he is engaged in ceaseless warfare. Since Windows is the primary operating system for computers worldwide, it is the primary target for those seeking to infiltrate, destroy, pilfer, or hijack computers for nefarious purposes. In addition to developing and marketing its operating system and software, the company is increasingly engaged in this running battle. It's a very sophisticated contest. Malware is a thriving global industry, fleecing Microsoft's customers with scams that range from the crude and obvious sexual come-ons and mountebank schemes to the more subtle, like this worm, which was rapidly and silently assembling what threatened to become a very large botnet. TJ is in charge of disrupting these constant incursions and helping to catch those responsible. He and his colleagues labor to be proactive. They try to spot and patch vulnerabilities before the bad guys can fully exploit them, which is precisely what they had done with this one. Microsoft's Redmond campus is a new and impressive corporate center outside Seattle that, at least from above, resembles not a microchip exactly, although that would have been perfect, but the innards of an old watch, a spring-driven watch with all its intricate gears, wheels, and escapement arms, albeit one with trees, sculptured lawns, and gardens. Viewed from above, it contains a number of identical four-armed office buildings that curve toward rounded points at the end of each arm, like the teeth of simple sprockets. From the ground, the giant sprockets are uniform in color, tan stone with green-tinted windows, and three stories high. There is an erector-set feel to the place, a very tidy world where form rigorously follows function, where thousands of casually dressed young people in sneakers and jeans and wearing rumpled backpacks move under sheltered sidewalks like electrons marching along programmed routes, all of them fiercely pretending, in that laid-back Pacific Northwest way, not to be at work. Here is the home of the Windows operating system, the software that mediates the computer experience for most of the billions of clueless who handle a keyboard or mouse every day. The sophisticated graphics-based wizardry of today's Windows rests on a fulcrum of the old MS-DOS system written in the 1970s when Bill Gates and others got the immeasurably lucrative idea that computers should be easy to use even for those who knew nothing about how they worked, perhaps the premier jackpot notion of the 20th century. Gates and Paul Allen, his buddy from Lakeside, an exclusive Seattle prep school, had hit upon the idea of writing an easy-to-use computer operating system in 1974, after Allen saw a cover story in Popular Electronics about something entirely new, a personal computer. At a time of enormous, bulky mainframes, the Altair 8080 was a kit marketed by a company called Micro Instrumentation and Telemetry Systems, MITS, that could be assembled into a working microcomputer in your own home. Few expected much of a market for it beyond avid computer hobbyists. If users managed to put it together correctly, many did not, they could operate it only by manipulating toggle switches to program the computer with object code, the ones and zeros of binary language. Gates and Allen were solidly in the demographic of the Altair 8080. They had fallen in love with computers at Lakeside as teenagers and saw immediately that demand for the Altair would grow significantly if the machine were easier to use. Utilizing BASIC, one of the earliest computer languages, they tailored a program to accomplish that goal and then sold it to MITS in Albuquerque in 1975. They incorporated as Micro-Soft at the same time, and launched the business that would make both young men super rich, along with a fair number of techies they enlisted to help them. From the beginning, the genius of Microsoft had depended not only on technology, but just as much, maybe even more, on shrewd business sense and careful market positioning, which seemed to come naturally to Gates in particular. The most lucrative step in the company's development came 5 years after the Altair, when IBM selected Microsoft, by then it had lost the hyphen, to provide the software for its entry into the burgeoning personal computer market. This was Microsoft Disk Operating System, MS-DOS. IBM was the leading name in computers at the time. The computer giant had either been caught napping or deliberately waited out the early years of personal computer development. Accounts vary. Before introducing a home model designed to appeal to mainstream users, a machine that relied less on innovation than on standardization. Projecting that within the decade computers would be as commonplace in the home as TV sets, IBM intended to launch a microcomputer that borrowed the most successful features of the experimental machines being sold by Apple, Tandy, MITS, and other pioneers, and use its own manufacturing and promotional clout to grab the largest share of this emerging market. The product was a machine that could reliably and simply perform the most common tasks users asked of it, mostly word processing and simple statistical analysis. It had to be readily compatible with the large variety of software being written to capitalize on the home computing phenomenon. Gates and Allen had already proved themselves masters of this new art and won the competition to handle the software side of the PC. When it proved successful beyond anyone's expectations, they rode its sails straight into the stratosphere. Some of the world's youngest billionaires were minted. A generation of hopeful geeks began migrating to Silicon Valley with plans to conjure the next digital miracle. Perhaps the most remarkable thing about Microsoft was that its biggest coup was yet to come. It reached historic peaks of commercial fortune in a series of increasingly bold leaps. After getting established with an operating system for the Altair 8080 and then scoring big with MS-DOS, Gates, Allen had by now withdrawn with his billions from an active role in the company, spurred his already large and extremely successful enterprise to create Windows, the most successful software venture ever. If we look back at MS-DOS today, it seems almost comically primitive and awkward. Home users were still working with a display screen that consisted of blinking lines of type on a dark screen, little more than the video equivalent of a typewriter display. Meanwhile, a host of exciting new applications were being developed that utilized the machine's mounting capabilities, most notably the ability to generate interactive visual images. The two primary ideas behind Windows were not new. They were known to the entire software industry in the 1980s. One was to design a graphical user interface, GUI, that would greatly simplify computer use by enabling users to point and click on visual images or icons instead of typing out commands. The second was to sandwich in a new layer of software, an interface manager, between the operating system and the applications, word processing, calculation, games, journalism, spreadsheet analysis, etc., that would enable users to switch easily from one to the other, or even display multiple functions simultaneously. It would take Microsoft the rest of the decade to perfect Windows, even as Steve Jobs at Apple introduced Lisa and then the Macintosh 128K, which beat it to the market by a wide margin. Microsoft introduced two early versions of Windows in the 1980s that were widely considered inferior to the competition, but successfully overleaped everyone else in May 1990 with Windows 3.0. To accomplish it, Gates had hired experienced software developers away from competing firms, locked up agreements with more than 20 computer manufacturers to endorse the new system while it was still in development, and then strolled out on a stage in New York City to announce the breakthrough product in what he called the most extravagant, extensive, and expensive $3 million software introduction ever. The awkward teenager, whose parents once forbade him to use a computer for months for fear his personal growth was being stunted by the machine, had evolved into not just a software innovator and skillful high-stakes businessman, but a showman. Windows took off immediately and just kept on selling. Gates became the richest man in the world, a pinnacle he owned for most of the next 20 years. From the beginning, the software business was a cutthroat enterprise. Both hardware and software were relatively easy to clone and copy, so success from the earliest days meant both artfully borrowing from the competition and ferociously policing the borders of your own products. The first Windows operating system, introduced in 1985, was influenced by, critics have said stolen from, ideas pioneered by other innovators. Gates became famous for his sharp elbows. To protect and enlarge Microsoft's franchise and his fortune, he took steps that some considered unfair and monopolistic, including the U.S. Department of Justice and the European Commission. Much of the disdain for Microsoft among members of the geek tribe stems from this fact. The software giant's riches and competitive excesses would probably be forgiven if Windows were seen as not just the richest, but the best. Fairly or not, the opposite is the case. Many geeks view Windows' various great leaps forward, Windows 95, XP, 2001, Vista, 2007, Windows 7, 2009, as dubious adaptations of an inherently flawed design. One of the big problems with Windows, which the tribe sees as preventable, is that the operating system is especially vulnerable to the predations of malware. Not everyone believes Windows is most targeted only because it owns the biggest share of the market. Whatever its alleged failings, and however uncool Microsoft has been made to appear in Apple's clever advertising campaigns, Windows operating systems still run most of the computers in the world, by far. The system itself consists of literally millions of lines of code that support a virtual galaxy of applications, from the profound to the mundane. It's organic, in that it is constantly evolving, and has become far too complex for any one person to fully grasp. The size of the Redmond campus, which employs more than 10,000 people, just over one-tenth of Microsoft's worldwide workforce, reflects this bewildering specialization, with whole divisions of the company, whole sprockets, devoted to a growing variety of software. TJ's specialty is protection. He does not look like a geek. He is tall and athletic, with long arms and legs, broad shoulders, a wide, round, clean-shaven face, and rimless glasses. He spent his youth playing sports, baseball, football, soccer, pretty much anything, he says, and mostly misspent the early years of his college education. Now in his 30s, he still looks like a jock. He has a loose, easy gait and a resolutely informal manner. He wears his hair cropped close and often covers it with a baseball cap. He was wearing a blue one with the gold initials FBI on the front the day I met him in 2010. The path to his present position was determined not so much by technical interest or ability as by a desire to catch bad guys. Law enforcement was his original goal. He took a somewhat lackadaisical 9-year path through Florida State University in the 1990s, overindulging, by his own account, in the ample social opportunity afforded by the steamy Tallahassee campus, before knuckling down to earn an undergraduate degree in criminology and then a master's degree in information science. The field is only partly related to computers, but TJ had a stronger-than-usual relationship with digital networks even then. When graduation appeared on the horizon, he applied for jobs with several federal law enforcement and intelligence agencies. He had his heart set on the CIA, where he might have an impact, he says. But a friend pointed out that his resume might also interest a software company. During his last few years at school, TJ had a part-time job as an IT, information technology, aide for one of the university's departments. He worked his way up from supporting desktop software to systems manager for the entire department. His parents had gotten him one of the early PCs in the late 1980s, when PCs were starting to become a fixture of home offices, and he had learned enough on it to understand, by the time he went to college, the advantages of linking his computer to the university's large and powerful network. He experimented with using multiple modems to broaden his bandwidth when connecting, and apart from the convenience afforded by the network's speed and accessibility, he discovered caches of new movies and music, places where internet pirates had stashed their illicit goods. This was a common practice. Video and audio files took up lots of space, so pirates would hack their way into large computer networks and stash their stolen goods in obscure corners where they were likely to go unnoticed. With triple the normal bandwidth, TJ was able to construct honeypots, where he could study the methodology behind the ever-increasing attacks. He learned a lot about how internet predators gained access to networks, and watched a free movie or two now and then. He was not actually stealing the material, see? It was already stolen. It also gave him a real sense for the emerging world of cybercrime. His facility with computers and networks landed him a full-time IT job, where, between installing machines, checking out applications, and building campus networks, he began dealing with increasingly frequent and sophisticated efforts to break into his department's files. This awakened TJ's inner Batman. He learned to apply monitoring tools like port mirrors to snare and track the invaders. Such work was obsessively interesting, toe-to-toe with the villains, and he was soon more driven by crime-fighting than by the routine IT chores or his classes, hence his desire to chase bad guys for real as a federal agent. The Fed jobs were competitive, particularly after the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001 fired up patriotic instincts on college campuses. So to cover all his bases, TJ dropped off his resume with a visiting Microsoft recruiter. He didn't even stay for the guy's whole presentation, so he was surprised when he got an email the next day inviting him to drop by for a screening interview. Microsoft hired him a few months later, the day before he got married in December, after a grueling, day-long round of interviews in Charlotte, North Carolina. The phone call offering him the job delayed his attendance at the rehearsal dinner, but his bride's pique faded quickly when she learned her groom had landed a good job. TJ progressed rapidly from enterprise-level network support engineering to security work, a growing concern at Microsoft just then. It was a period of rapid growth for malware, and the job handed him the challenge throughout the last decade of matching the miscreants stride for stride. Much like Microsoft, malware had begun to embrace specialization. Among the new things TJ saw were pre-packaged exploits, essentially break-in vehicles that allowed criminals to load on whatever scam they wished. These exploit kits were marketed to garden-variety spammers and thieves who no longer needed sophisticated hacking skills to get started. It meant that every newly discovered exploit launched not just one crime, but many, and potentially multiplied the earnings of its inventor manifold, with the added bonus that the exploit itself was not criminal. Prosecuting its creator would be like going after Black & Decker every time a thief used one of its drills to break into a safe. There were highly skilled programmers all over the world probing for a new weakness in Windows, crafting an exploit, and then openly marketing their invention to less tech-savvy crooks. Botnets were the new big thing. Most internet scams have a predictable rate of return. The percentage of people fooled into sending money is small, but if the net is cast widely enough, the returns can be large. Microsoft estimates that 5% of computer users fall for malware trickery, downloading programs that infect their computers, often despite on-screen warnings not to do so. Some phishing attacks on social networks, messages that trick computer operators into revealing valuable personal data or credit card account numbers, have shown a success rate of 70%. So an exploit that can guarantee reaching a large enough number of computers is a valuable tool indeed, more like a license to print money. Nothing is more valuable in this context than a large, stable, secure botnet, a network of vulnerable computers not just accessible but controlled by an outside operator. The pressure it mounts on cyber defenders is unceasing. It is harder to defend a computer than to attack it. Microsoft's security technicians spend considerable amounts of their time plugging newly discovered holes and issuing patches to mend them. This is not scary esoteric stuff. This is as real as picking a lock, albeit not as simple. Anyone who uses Windows on their home computer is familiar with routine security updates, which Microsoft issues on the second Tuesday of each month. In the tribe, it has become known as Patch Tuesday. In September 2008, a group of Chinese hackers began marketing an exploit for $37 that attacked a hitherto unknown weakness at port 445 of the Windows operating system. The Chinese hackers were not breaking any laws. They did not attempt any criminal acts. Their product was just a tool for breaking into the heart of a computer running Windows. The first serious effort to use the kit was seen weeks after the kit appeared in Vietnam, on September 29th. A strain of malware dubbed Gimiv quickly spread from Hanoi to 23 nations. Malaysia was hardest hit. Gimiv was identified by most security experts as a Trojan, a type of malware that attaches itself to a legitimate program and goes to work when the operator turns it on. The Trojan then copied all of the registry information in the invaded computer, all of its logon and personal data, and sent it back to the attacker. As a scam, Gimiv had serious design flaws that limited its effectiveness, but the exploit had worked perfectly. Others were sure to notice. TJ knew it probably meant a race to exploit the newly discovered vulnerability at port 445. Ports are listening points in the system, designed to transmit and receive particular kinds of data. There are 65,353 in Windows, because users value speed, so they want their computers to be able to do many things simultaneously. A firewall is a gatekeeper. It sniffs incoming packets of code and either grants or denies or redirects them according to the rules that govern each port. To penetrate the firewall, a packet of code needs to match up with a port. It needs to present itself as something the port is designed to receive. Only certain, very specific kinds of data can flow through, and then only with the appropriate codes. Some ports, like Transmission Control Protocol TCP-25, which handles email, are heavily trafficked. Most are not. They listen for updates and instructions that deal with narrow and specific functions, usually routine procedures that never rise to the notice of computer users. The number of ports is determined by TCP and UDP protocols, which are used to trigger the right listening service on the operating system. If a message comes to a port that lacks the right listening service for it, the port is said to be closed. Otherwise, the port is open, and the computer will receive the message, oftentimes sending a reply to the sender. In Windows, there are a few ports that are open by default unless there is a firewall to control access. One of them is port 445. On a Windows machine, port 445 triggers a service called Remote Procedure Call, RPC, which allows other computers to print or share files with it. Because of the complexity of the RPC service, the legacy of various generations of Windows, and the intimacy of the service with the heart of the operating system, called the kernel, there are lots of instances where an error in programming allows an attacker to deliver invalid data, instructions which may cause the service to perform tasks for which it was not intended. This is a problem common to large software systems. A vulnerability in RPC permits a level of control over the computer that a vulnerability in, say, Internet Explorer would not. Remotely controlling Internet Explorer would enable a miscreant to compel your computer to download pornography or adware, the kind of exploit that is immediately and painfully obvious. Seizing control of the kernel gives a remote operator access deeper than a user would ever see, right to the mind and soul of the computer. He would, effectively, own it. At that point, the owner of the infected computer has been pwned. Royally. The hard part was not entering through port 445. It was fooling the operating system into downloading the exploit's malware. To accomplish that, the Chinese kid employed a buffer overflow, one of the hacker's oldest tricks. It works like this. An outside computer comes knocking at the door with a packet of code. Once it arrives, the operating system needs to find where to put it. So it dispatches a collection of programs called network services. Think of network services as a recipe book that explains how to make various dishes, and the computer as a chef who is avidly reading this book. If the process were simple, the chef would select the correct recipe or program and download the new packet. But the process is not simple. Nearly every program involves a variety of subroutines which interrupt the primary task along the way. These subroutines are, in effect, small packets of memory created within the pre-existing memory stack, parentheses within parentheses, like nesting Russian dolls. For example, once the chef chooses what looks like the right recipe from the book and starts reading, say, from page 73, he is interrupted and told that a remote client has placed an urgent order for a cake. To service the request, the chef immediately flips to the chapter, or program subroutine, that explains how to prepare cakes, say page 141. But before he digs into the cake recipe, he creates a temporary memory stack, call it an addendum to the cake recipe, and places a bookmark there, called a pointer, to remind him where he left off, page 73, and where he needs to return once the cake is baked. Then he sets about making the cake, which has its own subroutines, like, say, contacting the customer to find out whether he wants angel food or chocolate. Here is where the malware programmer performs his trick. He is the cake customer. He gives the chef a list of his requirements for the cake, and he knows from previous observation that these instructions will be placed by the chef in an addendum, or the temporary stack, which is called a buffer. The evil programmer knows exactly how big that buffer is, so in addition to giving the chef details of the cake he wants, he continues to feed the chef unrelated information. If the chef is undiscerning, as port 445 proved to be, the superfluous data will overflow the allotted buffer space and spill into the addendum, so that the chef inadvertently overwrites his pointer, the one telling him to return to page 73 when he is finished. Instead, the cake instructions now send him in an entirely new direction, like, say, telling the chef, who is a very literal-minded fellow and follows instructions like a machine, to fetch a key and open a safe he keeps in a back room. This information, which has nothing to do with cake instructions, is duly recorded at the bottom of the addendum. So when the chef finishes with the cake and checks his addendum to know where he needs to return, he is directed back not to page 73, but to the back room and the safe. If the right check is in place, the computer at that point would simply reject the incoming packet or complain, send up a specific warning message to the computer user that only very few comprehend. There are ways for the service to check to see if the space it allocated is large enough or if an attacker has successfully written too much information, either of which would abort the invasion. But the service must do that at every single point. And there could be thousands of such points in a complex program like RPC. The Chinese discovered one point that wasn't adequately protected. So instead of the RPC service simply aborting the process and shutting down the buffer, just as the handle of a gas pump will automatically shut down when the tank is full, the computer, or chef, continues processing the data along this new and unauthorized path. This is the essence of the exploit. Like all programs, network services list data and instructions, a set of procedures that the computer follows faithfully. The invading code now steers its malware package wherever the programmer has told it to go. And because port 445 is buried deep in the operating system, the payoff for an intrusion there is big. The lock has been picked. Microsoft learned of this new exploit as soon as the Chinese hackers began selling it, and recognized that it potentially posed a major threat. It was wormable. That is, it was the kind of attack that would allow for the insertion of a worm, which could then propagate itself into a botnet. It could execute a remote procedure call. In other words, the computer could be handed over to a remote operator. The threat was serious enough that the company decided to issue its hastily designed patch for this vulnerability, MS-08-067, Microsoft 2008 Patch 67, out of band. That is, it decided not to wait until the next Patch Tuesday. TJ was at a four-day International Botnet Task Force meeting in Arlington, Virginia, hosted by Carnegie Mellon University on October 23, 2008, when MS-08-067 was announced and made available for download. The timing gave him a chance to explain it in person to some of the top security researchers in the world. When the final decision was relayed to him from Redmond, he stood up with his associate, Richie Lai, to announce it. "Hey, I want everybody to go onto Microsoft.com/technet/security, he said. "There's an out-of-band release." The company release accompanying the patch explained, "On Microsoft Windows 2000, Windows XP, and Windows Server 2003 systems, an attacker could exploit this vulnerability without authentication to run arbitrary code. It is possible that this vulnerability could be used in the crafting of a wormable exploit." Many at the meeting downloaded the patch immediately and began dissecting it. TJ spent the next few minutes explaining it and answering questions, and then met with people from the FBI to brief them the same afternoon. "We think this is going to be a big deal," he told the agents. "You guys really need to start looking at that." In a perfect world, the patch would end the problem. But as TJ well knew, MS-08-067 was more likely to make things worse. Anyone who downloaded it would be protected from the exploit, so Microsoft had to release it in order to protect its most diligent customers. But the patch itself was better advertising than the Chinese hackers could ever afford. It was like placing in orbit a flashing neon billboard so gaudy that it could be seen everywhere on Earth with the naked eye. "Come one, come all, a new Windows vulnerability." In fact, the patch itself most likely inspired the new worm's creation. Many, many computer operators worldwide failed to diligently heed security updates. Millions of Windows systems around the world have been bootlegged, counterfeited, or installed without authorization. If everyone registered his software and applied new patches promptly, Windows would be nigh impregnable. But because so many people failed to do so, Patch Tuesday, or in this case an out-of-band patch, has become part of Microsoft's problem. It is as if the commander of a fort made a public announcement. The back door to the supply shed in the southeast corner of the garrison has a broken lock. Here's how to fix it. If there were only one well-policed fort, the lock would be fixed and the vulnerability would disappear. But when you are defending millions of forts, and a goodly number snooze right through the public announcement, the patches simply point out the unlocked door. They don't just invite attack, they provide instructions. This was scary stuff if you allowed yourself to really think about it, which few did. It pointed up a flaw in the founding, let's join hands and sing, techno-utopian spirit of the Internet itself, a flaw so basic that it could not be fixed. It suggested some kind of social equivalence to entropy, an unbendable curve toward ruin. It was proof, as if further proof were needed, that nothing works exactly as intended. Making computers easy for everyone to use was the germ of the idea that made Bill Gates and Paul Allen into two of the richest men in the world. But by inviting everybody to the computer revolution, they threw open the doors to the technologically ignorant, which is to say, most of us. This would prove to be enormously frustrating in later years to those who understood most and cared most about the Internet. If everyone would only take simple precautions, but that was never going to happen. It had been tough enough to get users to pay attention when malware was primitive, when it stomped in with muddy boots and ground its heels into their hard drives. How were you going to get them to pay attention when the malware was so stealthy that only the most alert and well-trained technician could detect it? When the thing to be protected was not so much the individual PC as the Internet itself. People simply would never understand. And even if they did, they lacked discipline. In a free society, you could not reach in and update their software for them. Just imagine the howls of indignation, the bad PR, the class action lawsuits. Big Brother tickling the innards of your very own machine. It was about as clear a violation of the techno-utopian ideal as could be imagined. The implication was that this billion-headed, globally connected marvel would always be vulnerable, and not just to predation. It could be weaponized. It could be crippled or even crashed at the whim of some technically proficient cyber gang, or perhaps even by some borderline Asperger's teenager who woke up on the wrong side of the bed. And even when you did everything right, even when you anticipated the exploit and turned out the patch in record time, it just made things worse. Sure enough, as soon as MS-08-067 appeared, demand for the Chinese exploit kit grew so fast that its creators began giving it away. There was a new outbreak of GMIV in Asia. Security experts were not too worried about GMIV, which was amateurish, but they could see the potential. If the bad people find out how to use this, we're in big trouble, wrote Eric Seitz, a researcher for Sunbelt, a security software firm. He warned that a better-designed piece of malware, like a worm, could be created very easily and wreak havoc. 28 days after MS-08-067 appeared, the very thing popped up on Phil Porras' infections log at SRI and started burrowing its way into unprotected computers everywhere. And nobody, nobody was less surprised than T.J. Campana. 3. Remote Thread Injection. If he came here, it was for a reason. A darker reason than you can imagine, sir. The Amazing X-Men. Hassan Saidi took it personally when the worm shrugged off SRI's unpacking software. The tool to pry open malware, to slice right through the layers of protective and deceptive coating, had been created by Hassan, along with Monerul Sharif, a graduate assistant. They called it Eureka. Any malware that resisted it was a personal challenge and an opportunity to improve Eureka. Hassan is the data flow analyst on Phil Porras' staff. He is a native of Algeria who migrated to Menlo Park after earning his doctorate in computer science in France. He's firmly in the Internet idealist camp. He sees the web as one of the most revolutionary developments in human history and regards the efforts of criminals, nihilists, and terrorists to prey on it as reprehensible. More and more, the world as we know it depends on the smooth interaction of computers. The Internet has become the collective mind of humanity, its eyes and ears, and memory. As old paper repositories convert to digital storage, and as the new trail of modern civilization increasingly inhabits the digital realm, it has become, in a sense, the new Library of Alexandria. Better than most, security pros like Hassan recognize how easy it would be to burn it down. At the dawn of the computer age, hackers were mostly a nuisance, motivated by a desire to show off. Today, the most serious computer predators are funded by rich criminal syndicates and even nation-states, and their goals are far more ambitious. Cyber attacks were launched at digital networks in Estonia by ethnic Russian protesters in 2007, and in Georgia before Russia attacked that country in 2008. And someone, probably Israel or the United States, or both, successfully loosed a worm called Stuxnet in 2010 to sabotage computer-controlled uranium centrifuges inside Iran's secretive nuclear program. Botnets have been employed in lucrative global scams and syndicates. In October 2010, the Zeus Trojan, a kit that can be used to create a botnet, has been responsible for infecting nearly 4 million computers in the United States alone. One Zeus-based scam was discovered to have plundered more than $70 million from the bank accounts of tens of thousands of unwitting victims. Those behind such efforts are often every bit as skilled as those charged with stopping them. The two sides in this war are fellow members of the geek tribe, engaged in a highly cerebral and esoteric contest at the cutting edge of computer programming. The stakes are high. Staying one step ahead of the botmaster, the miscreants, or bad guys, or black hats, as the security community dubs them, is a constant challenge. The obscure work these experts do, the work that is so hard for most people to understand, may not be as romantic or physically daring as the work of the pilots who flew those fighters on Phil Porras's office wall, or the assault force in 2011 that killed Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, but it is every bit as vital and compelling. The threat may be virtual, but the consequences would be all too real. A successful computer attack could compromise nuclear reactors, electrical grids, transportation networks, pipelines, you name it. Earlier this year, the Pentagon formulated its first-ever formal cyber strategy, which found that a cyber attack on the United States originating in another country would be considered as much an act of war as dropping bombs on Buffalo, one that would justify a traditional military response. It is, of course, always easier to tear something down than to build it up, easier to break into a computer than to protect it, so the good guys work at a constant disadvantage. The tide of malware is relentless. Battling it without losing heart requires both steadfast resolve and, at some level, faith in man's essential goodness. With dark semicircles under his big brown eyes, Hassan has the look of the creature Weizenbaum sketched back in 1976, a man who spends too many hours bathed in the light of a computer screen. He is 40, with thick brown curls that have begun to gray at the temples. His aptitude and learning have been seasoned with decades of experience. He has honed one very specific skill to a fine art. If he is not the best at what he does, he would like to know who is. Hassan pursued computer studies in part to avoid direct competition within his accomplished family. His father is a professor of literature, and his mother an elementary school teacher. Five of his siblings have earned PhDs in various disciplines. Two of his older brothers were mathematicians, so when he graduated from high school, he decided to go a different way. The math brothers advised computer science, a growing field with plenty of opportunities for both study and employment, and Hassan heeded them, even though he had no particular love for computers, a circumstance that makes him different from most of those working at his level. After SRI recruited him from the French lab, he spent several years in Menlo Park, focusing on programming languages and computer reliability, but realized gradually that the real action was in the malware wars. He talked his way into the job, convincing Phil that his cutting-edge programming skills were ideally suited to dissecting the newest strains of malware. Nowadays, when people ask him what he does for a living, he says, "I track criminals." If they press for more detail, he'll confess that his crime fighting is relegated to the virtual space inside SRI's computer network, tracking viruses. Further explanation produces the glaze. At that point, he says, they're not interested. But how could anything be more interesting? A malicious program that appears impervious to dissection is the handiwork of someone or some group trying to prey on honest citizens in the global community, which is to say that the predator is trying, ultimately, to outsmart him. Arsène is that rare program analyst who is comfortable working not just with source code, any of the many programming languages, but with object code, the long strings of ones and zeros at the core of machine instruction. At that primary layer, a program's intent cannot be disguised or obfuscated. Once Arsène sinks his teeth into a piece of malware, the question is not if he can unpack and dissect it, but how long it will take him to do so. What makes it hard, and what makes Arsène's world so devilishly difficult to understand, is not just the complexity of modern computer operating systems, but the fact that much of what takes place inside them can be grasped and described only conceptually. Software is abstract. It's also very real, of course, but not real the way an internal combustion engine is real. Inside an operating system, there are no visible moving parts. It is a world of electromagnetic charges orchestrated to move along pathways that make decisions and create memory. There are many levels of memory, from the kind that sticks around on a hard drive forever, to the kind that is so evanescent it exists for only microseconds, for as long as it takes a computer to step through some lightning-fast computation. Every program is ultimately a list of instructions written in the ones and zeros of object code, which represent slightly different electrical charges. It breaks down complex tasks into a series of steps so basic that they can be expressed in a long series of binary decisions, or logic gates, which are executed by the computer's central processing unit, CPU. The art of programming is breaking complex tasks into these fundamental steps. It is maddeningly precise work, because computers are maddeningly literal. Bill Gates once said, "Most great programmers have some mathematical background, because it helps to have studied the purity of proving theorems, where you don't make soft statements, you only make precise statements." Say, for instance, your body was a machine with a CPU, which in a sense it is, and you wished to stand up from a chair, walk across the room, and fix a cup of coffee. You would begin by telling each of the dozens of muscles involved in rising from a seated position to perform their functions, flex or relax, while monitoring balance readings from your inner ear and rerouting orders for muscular adjustments to make sure you don't fall over sideways. By the time you have walked across the room, reached up to remove a cup from the cupboard, picked up the coffee pot, etc., you have executed a blizzard of binary decisions. The various source codes or computer languages are shorthand versions of object code, designed to make a program accessible to human programmers. If standing up and crossing the room and pouring a cup of coffee constitute a routine task, it might be rendered in source code simply as "get coffee," which automatically refers the CPU to a standard predetermined sequence. We have all experienced the sensation of performing quotidian tasks on autopilot. But in order to perform even the simplest of tasks, the computer, just like the mind of a man crossing the room to pour a cup of coffee, must remember things, sometimes for split seconds, sometimes for longer. To make the cup of coffee, we must access core memories, like which ingredients to mix and in what amounts, or how to operate the coffee maker. And to stand across the room, to lift and to pour, we must create transient memories, like those continual readings from the inner ear to maintain balance. Inside the operating system of a modern computer, there are similar, multi-layered memory functions operating simultaneously, along pathways meticulously prescribed by the program. To understand this new worm, either Arsène had to set it running and carefully observe it step by step, a dynamic analysis, or he had to, in effect, unspool its programming language so that he could read it step by painstaking step, a static analysis. But first he had to find it. The worm may have been cunningly packed, but if it was to do its thing inside its host, the infected computer itself had to recognize how to open it. If you could watch that happen, step by step, you would learn how to unpack it yourself. But where inside the operating system of a newly infected computer did the worm hatch? Malware is packed for two reasons. First, for compression, because to disseminate widely around the Internet, the data packet needs to be small. Second, for self-protection, to make it harder for antivirus software to recognize it and for someone like Hassan to take it apart and study it. The worm itself consisted of only a few hundred lines of code, no more than 35 kilobytes, slightly smaller than a 2,000-word document. The average home computer today has about 2 gigabytes of memory, well over 1.5 million times greater. If you were not looking for it, and unless you knew how to look for it, you would never see it. The worm drifts in like a moat. In order to prevent the kind of analysis Hassan wished to perform, its designers had made it particularly hard to follow once it entered a new machine. They had, in effect, covered the worm's tracks, and they had provided a false trail to throw pursuers off the scent. They also applied a dual-layer encryption method, like Russian nesting dolls, capable of defeating most unpacking software and security ninjas. Most. Hassan is not easily fooled. He minutely traced the code's tricky pathway into his virtual computer. The worm used the Chinese exploit to enter port 445, taking advantage of the buffer overflow to write itself in as a dynamic link library, DLL, the device Microsoft programmers crafted to enable computers to exchange data. Regular users know nothing about program languages or varying exchange protocols. They just want the thing to run. So Microsoft invented a way to bundle executable programs and data, the DLL, that allows them to be smoothly exchanged by computers on different networks. Once inside, the worm, now a DLL, proceeded along a standard path. It was directed to svchost.exe, short for Service Host, which is a check-in point for incoming files of this type. Service Host then ran its Load Library function, which does what it says it does. It uploads the new file. If the worm served some legitimate function, it would then have been initialized and handed over to the computer user, or it would have failed to initialize and been given the boot. The latter is what appeared to happen. When the DLL timed out, Service Host raised an exception and aborted the load. This was the false trail. There was nothing to suggest anything more had happened. To most people, even those monitoring the system very carefully, the incoming packet had failed to initialize and was now gone. Of course, as Hassan well knew, the worm was not gone. It had performed a nasty trick. The first level unpacking at Service Host had released nesting dolls, not one, but two distinct packets, one for code, another for data. The data packet functioned the way you would expect. It informed the system that it was incompatible and that it had self-destructed. The other, the code packet, opened up a memory, a protected memory segment, and then decrypted and installed itself. It pushed that segment off as a